Welcome to the Conservative Thought Hour, where America always comes first.
I'm proud to be an American.
Each week, we bring you captivating guests who will speak on many topics of national interest. We are not interested in telling you what to think or how to think. We have faith that you can do that for yourself. Our interest is to bring you information to help you form your own opinions. As always, the views expressed by our guests are their own and are not necessarily shared by the host or the station you are listening to. Get ready for enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
And now, here are your hosts, Carrie Black and Rick Stannard.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Stannard, your host of the Conservative Thought Hour. Today's guest is Dorian Abbott. Dorian is a professor of geophysics at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Dorian. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Fabulous. So there you were. We're going to jump right into this. There you were, a quiet, happy, tenured science professor at a well-respected university. And then one day, you're a target of a whole lot of people you've never met. What in the world happened?
Well, I started speaking out in favor of treating each person as an individual worthy of dignity and respect. And
there's a mortal sin.
Yeah. So in an academic context, specifically, that means when people apply to go to school or for a faculty position, that people should be treated primarily as an individual and judged based on their merits. And additionally, we should respect other people's freedom to voice their opinions, which is another aspect of treating other people with dignity.
So what happened? People started attacking you. How did they do that?
Well, so the way these things play out is it generally starts with a group of people on Twitter that they use Twitter as a kind of a force multiplier. So it's often not that large of a group, a couple dozen people, and they start saying lots of really scary sounding things about the scholar that they're targeting, like racist, white supremacist, et cetera, bigot, things like this. They get people to like their posts and they sort of pass them around. And then this is sort of shown to some sort of decision maker to try to force a punishment on the scholar. It often culminates after that in a letter of denunciation that a bunch of people sign, some of them potentially true believers in this effort, and some of them presumably feel intimidated and sign as a result.
Wow. Okay. So you're not a right-wing ideologue. You identify as a political centrist. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. The way I vote is I go on the website I side with. I fill out their 100 or 150 questions on policy. It gives me a percent overlap with the candidates. And then I have a Python script that I wrote, and I enter in the percent overlap, and it randomly assigns my vote with a weighting based on the percent overlap.
Oh, now that's terrific. That's a scientific voting method.
Exactly.
Okay, so now you're identified as a political enemy of a lot of people, maybe even a dread domestic terrorist.
I haven't been called that yet, luckily.
Well,
maybe I will soon.
Just you wait, it'll happen. There are a lot more people who support your position that are on the right. You know, I mean, if we took the political spectrum and assigned the value 1 to the left and 10 to the far right, you'd be a 5.
Yeah, let's say.
The Republicans generally would be a 7, and the Democrats generally would be a 3. But the Democrats are no longer a 3. There are 2 easily, and they're paddling hard to get to number 1 on the far left. So they see you as a five, and they think you're a right winger.
Well,
you haven't changed a bit.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is, like you said, that the positions of the main parties are moving around a little bit. So if you had the same position on a large number of issues in 2000 and in 2021, you would be considered center-left in 2000 and right-wing in 2021. So that's happening. And the other issue is that on a college campus, being a five on your scale actually does make you on the right wing.
Yeah, well, it's really sad that nowadays you are, and you, not only you, but we are all forced to be politically minded, even if we don't want to be.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's an unfortunate situation.
You know, I'm sure you'd much rather teach geophysics and all those good things, and I'd much rather be a musician. But here I am trying to lend some intelligence to life and by getting people like you to talk about what's happened.
Well, thank you for lending intelligence, because that's what we need right now.
Oh, boy, is that the truth. Well, you know, we never tell our audience either what to think or how to think.
That's really important.
Yep. All we want to do is give them both sides of all arguments and let them make their own mind up. Last week I had Larry Lessig, a professor of law at Harvard, and a committed Democrat. And it was a marvelously interesting talk. And I've had responses from around the world to people who've listened to it. So at least we're doing something right. And that's worthwhile.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. So were you unaware of the changes happening in our institutions of higher education before this blew up in your face? Was this whole thing a surprise? Or
well, I have to say, somewhere in the middle. So I had realized that people were talking in a strange way that seemed to be at odds with what I thought were the fundamentals of Americanism. I had also noticed on college campus a huge degree of self-censorship, including by myself. People were afraid to talk openly about a whole variety of subjects. However, I also was, I think, a little bit naive, because when this first started, I thought I could just explain why these things were a problem and it would be convincing to people. And that was definitely not the case.
Yeah, I find the same difficulty. People, if they're listening to something outside of their belief, they turn off. They're not willing to take a chance and listen.
Part of it's a toleration of discomfort. So it is uncomfortable to hear someone make an argument that challenges your beliefs, but we have to just be okay with that, tolerate the discomfort, hear them out, and consider the argument on a rational basis.
And isn't that what university education is all about?
I think it is. I think it should be. I think it was, and it is sometimes when it works well, and hopefully it will be in the future.
Well, you're not, I'm sure you know you are not the only professor in this little particular boat. You know, I think back to there's a school in Washington State called Evergreen College.
Yes.
And in 2017, the school was taken over by the students, literally taken over by the students, and they told every white person that they couldn't come to school on a certain day. And, you know, the faculty and the administration just caved in, except for one guy who's a science professor, not coincidentally, named Brett Weinstein.
Yeah.
And sadly, he's no longer teaching.
Yeah. And that's another example.
You know, I want to. He's teaching on another venue.
I want to take that and run with it for a moment. So he's actually a left winger. And so that really demonstrates how this isn't a right left political issue. This is a free society versus authoritarianism issue. So person, every American of goodwill who believes in an America that's a free society should be against this kind of cancel culture and censorship on campus.
It is frightening. And so many of the issues that we're fighting about are not left-right issues.
I agree,
They're issues that could be thought about and talked about and solved fairly easily. But for some reason, we want to get into a big brouhaha about every little thing. My own school, now I went to the University of Michigan, just up the road from you guys.
Yeah.
And they recently had a problem with a professor who was a world-renowned composer.
Yeah, and Bright, I think his name is.
Bright, yep. Teaching a class in the relationship between Verdi's opera and Shakespeare's play, Othello. And he played a movie of the Shakespeare's play made in 1962 with Laurence Olivier playing the Moor, who of course is black, in blackface. Now this movie's been seen a gazillion times all over the world, but some people decided that it was scary and offensive.
Well, you know, in a scenario like that, it's important to realize that we shouldn't just think that the people who say they're offended actually were offended. So often what's going on is something called moral grandstanding. It's a sort of performative offense. And the idea is to demonstrate to the other people in this crowd that you have the right ideology. And so you pretend to be offended, pretend that it was something awful, when in fact, there's no reason to necessarily assume that anyone was in fact offended.
Boy, is that the truth. And the difference, I think, is that Evergreen College and my school, the University of Michigan, collapsed.
Yeah.
The administration just collapsed and did not support logic or intelligence. Your administration, I believe, behaved differently. Is that true?
Yeah. So the University of Chicago has traditionally been very strong on academic freedom, particularly our former president, President Zimmer, who's now the chancellor. He was the president when we adopted the Chicago principles, which are sort of the gold standard for academic freedom. And when this issue arose for me, he issued a very strong statement that, just to give you a one sentence summary, said, our faculty are permitted to discuss any idea and criticize any university policy that they want using any forum they want, and we're not going to punish them.
Amen.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I don't know why an administration would want to cede their power to students.
Well, so I think what's one way you can think about this is that the administrator is not necessarily trying to optimize the university's cost function. They're trying to optimize their own cost function. And so it may be advantageous for their career progression to cave in, and they're willing to do that even if it destroys the reputation of the university and destroys the whole truth-seeking purpose of a university. That's sometimes what's at play.
Indeed, but you know, in maximizing your own position, how can it be logical to cede control like at Evergreen College?
Well, these aren't dumb people, so I'm assuming that there's some sort of pressures and incentives that are being set up that are causing them to make those choices. But not being an administrator, I don't know what those are exactly.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I predate you just a little bit. I was in Ann Arbor in the 1960s, and boy, was that a different time than today. For one, women were not allowed on the football field, so we only had male cheerleaders.
Oh, wow.
And women were not allowed to enter the Michigan Union building by the front door. They had to go in the side door.
Well, I guess some things have changed for the better.
Well, we had a lot of inequities. Nobody's arguing that. The 1960s were ripe for righting wrongs, And that's what kids do. That's what students should do. They should find out what's right and what's wrong and work to change it. The problem is, I don't think we've trained our kids nowadays on what's right and what's wrong.
No, they're growing up in a moral vacuum, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. So throughout history, we've had a habit of giving a man or a woman the opportunity to stand up and make a difference. That gets thrust upon some people, even though they don't want it. And not all of them accept the challenge. But you did. What made you say, no, I'm going to stand up and fight this?
Well, my wife was born in Ukraine, and she was baptized in secret as a result of an ideology that's not that dissimilar from the woke ideology, run amok and gaining control of society. And I don't want our children to grow up in that kind of society.
Yeah. So when this is all over, are you going to go back to being a nice tenured professor of geophysics, or are you going to continue to stand in support of your beliefs?
Both, I hope. I don't think that's an either or.
No, it's certainly not. What we don't want is for someone like you to disappear.
Yeah. Well, so we have this group called UChicago Free, which is a nonpartisan group of faculty at UChicago dedicated to promoting academic freedom. And so I'm participating in that. And some of us are hoping to raise money to start what we would call a Center for a Free Society, where we would invite lecturers and fellows and engage in difficult discussions without the fear of censorship. So those are sort of two projects in that sphere that I'm planning to continue.
Well, if I can lend any of my capabilities to that effort, please do not be afraid to call.
Thank
on
you.
Me.
I appreciate it.
I think we have to do this. All schools have to do this.
It would be great if every school could have such a center set up, and if all of the students and faculty could get used to the idea that sometimes you're going to hear people you disagree with, and that's okay.
Yep. The woke crowd seems to be drunk on power.
In terms of this woke ideology that's often talked about, an important forerunner of it was Foucault. And he had the cynical view that everything in society is based on power relations. And that seems to have infused the thinking of the woke crowd. And it's interesting because it's reflected in the actions that they take. They're often based simply on power plays.
Well, it's true. The only power that they have is that which we give them. All it takes to stop them is one single simple word. No.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
And I
look at this as, similar to a misbehaving child throwing a tantrum. You know, if you just immediately give in, that's not going to lead to future good behavior.
That's right. They're just going to take more and more.
Yeah.
And you don't help somebody by giving them that much power. They have to know their own boundaries, just like you and I have to know our own boundaries.
I agree.
Wow. Well, there's a growing number of schools that seem to be heading the wrong way. Do you know of any way to change that? I mean, there are 1.5 million college professors.
Yeah.
97% of them self-identify as Democrat, socialist, progressive, or communist.
I'm not sure about that exact number, but there's no question that the academy leans to the left.
It definitely does. And they're teaching our public school teachers. and there's 3.5 million of those, and 87%. And I don't know the numbers exactly. I'm just merely citing statistics that have been reported.
Yeah.
But 87% of the public school teachers who are teaching our kids,
yeah,
self-identify as Democrat, socialist, progressive, or communist.
Yeah.
And so we're just,
let me make a comment on that. So the,
yeah,
in terms of what we can do, the first thing is at a university level, I think it's important to have something like the Chicago Principles, or just the Chicago Principles themselves, adopted at a university, which basically say it doesn't matter if you're offended. It doesn't matter if you strongly disagree with someone. You got to hear them out in public lectures and in their writing. You can't just stop them from publishing and speaking on campus. And if you do try to do that, there's the following punishments in place. And the other thing is something we have at UChicago called the Calvin Report, which insists on institutional neutrality on important social and political issues. And the idea is, if the president of the university or even a department chair says, we think, this or that on any big issue like abortion or whatever, then that would reduce the ability of members of the community to object, because it would be establishing an official position. So those two things should be established on university campuses everywhere, I think. Now, in terms of the more general issue with the potential for indoctrination of children, I think, in my opinion, it's important not for the government not to be putting in place censorship of various ideas. It's more important to insist that the education of teachers and the education of children allows them to be exposed to different ideas and doesn't teach one approach as a sort of ironclad ideology that can't be disagreed with. I think that's a better direction to go than trying to censor ideas that you disagree with.
Well, I was lucky personally in high school. I had an economics teacher who taught all sides of economics, including communism and socialism and the differences. And you know, I came out a capitalist, so it's not going to kill you to hear the story.
Yeah. So, you know, Tom Sowell, professor,
yeah,
at Stanford.
Absolutely.
When he was asked what made you stop being a Marxist, he said facts. And so that's an example. If, you know, if you go with an open mind, some, you can go in with one ideological commitment, but if you're open to the empirical evidence, you can always change your mind.
I have followed Thomas since I was knee-high to a rattlesnake. I don't know how he keeps going, but he does. And he's an amazing thinker.
Have you read his most recent book, Charter Schools and Their Enemies?
I have not.
It's excellent. It came out this summer, written at age 90. And it goes through the various arguments for and against charter schools and does a very nice data analysis, and he concludes that charter schools are actually effective. But what's interesting about how he approaches these problems is he doesn't straw man his opponents. He gives, he gives their argument, and then he confronts it empirically. That's the critical thing. Non-ideologically, he just gives the evidence.
That's great. Now, Dorian, let's shift topics a bit, and let's move to climate. That's
great.
That's really your area of teaching, isn't it?
Yeah. So most of my research focuses on other planets, using the same sorts of models and equations, numerical models and equations that are used for climate change. But I use them to try to see if other planets that we detect could potentially have liquid water on them and questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I teach a large class on global warming at the university. It's usually taken by 500 to 700 students per year.
Wow. Is that a freshman class or is that everybody?
It's a class, it's a physical science class. The purpose is to educate the students on this specific topic, of course, but also more generally to help them develop quantitative skills. So calculations, and reading plots and things like that for non-science majors.
Good. Well, I want to tell you that you're talking to someone who's not a skeptic, but I have spent some time trying to understand the what's going on in climate. You know, I look at one group of people who are telling me the world's going to end in 12 years and that Miami's going to disappear under the waves and all sorts of things like, you know, polar bears dying out and baobab trees disappearing and all sorts of dread, fearful topics. And I want to understand it because they're asking for us to change not only our economy, but our whole life to accommodate this.
I think the best place to start is with the data in a discussion like this. So we should never believe the science or the authorities without questioning. That would be contrary to the whole idea of science. We should demand to be presented with the data. And I'm going to present you as a scientist with what I find to be the most convincing argument. So just from collecting the surface temperature from ships and from land stations, just measuring the temperature and writing it down, we know that over the last 170 years, the global mean temperature has increased by 2.1 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, we also know, based on measurements of the amount of carbon dioxide in the air and based on finding bubbles in the ice cores to go further back in time. So the measurements of carbon dioxide in the air have only been going on since 1960, but we can go into the ice and we can count up annual layers of ice and then take air bubbles out and measure the CO2. We also know that the carbon dioxide CO2 has increased by almost 50% over that period. And we know finally from radio physics, which describes emission absorption and transmission of electromagnetic radiation, we know that that amount of CO2 increase should cause roughly that change in temperature. And that radio physics is the same thing that we use to communicate with satellites, cell phones, have televisions work, things like that. So it's a fairly well understood type of physics. So those are the things that we know. There's more uncertainty if we try to predict the future, but the models that we have suggest that the global mean temperature could increase by about 15 degrees Fahrenheit based on the amount of coal and gas that we have available to us. And for comparison, during the last glacial maximum, Chicago was covered by a half mile of ice, and the global mean temperature was only 11 degrees colder. So those are that's sort of the basic facts around this, sort of indisputable facts. And then we can talk more about what they mean and what we should do about it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Let's talk for a second about carbon dioxide.
Yes.
I mean, we are all taught that carbon dioxide is an absolutely necessary gas.
Yes.
And that without it, we wouldn't exist because plants wouldn't exist. And there was a point about 100 years ago when our carbon dioxide level was 180 ppm. And the danger is that at 150 parts per million, plants reach CO2 starvation and die. So we were within a minuscule measurement.
When are you referring to? What time?
About 100 years ago.
So 100 years ago, the carbon dioxide was about 300 parts per million. About 10,000 years ago, it did reach as low as 180, 10 to 20,000 years ago during the last glacial maximum.
Okay. Well, so 100 years ago was 300, and that was, and now it's what, 410?
In that range, yeah.
Okay. And is that necessarily in and of itself bad?
Well, we have to define what we mean by bad. Bad for whom? And so what we can say is the last time the carbon dioxide level was this high was about 3 or 4 million years ago. and Earth was significantly different. That's what we can say.
Well, I do know that in the period known as the Cambrian explosion, which was some 50 million years ago, when the Earth greened and became a living ecosystem, that the CO2 was in around 4,000 parts per million.
Well, yeah, so the Cambrian's actually closer to 500 million years ago, and we have trouble estimating the CO2 that far back in time, so we don't really know, but it's important to emphasize that long discussions about what the CO2 was in the past are a little bit of a red herring. The fact is, humans weren't around then. Humans are around now. And the question is more about what the effect of adding a bunch of CO2 will have for humans in the future, and whether it will push us into a climate that we've never experienced, and whether this could disrupt agriculture and things like that.
Well, I appreciate your clearing things up for me. Like I said, I'm not a scientist, but I do a fair amount of reading, and I hope you will take my comments just as questions, not as doubting in any way. But here we are.
Doubt is important, right? It's important to ask for the arguments.
Exactly. Got to have the debate.
Yeah.
But here we are with one thing we've never had before, and that's 7+ billion people on Earth that have to be fed.
Yeah.
And what's one of the benefits of increasing CO2 is that crops are growing better.
So I can't speak to that. I'm not an expert on that particular subfield.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did read that organic farmers, in cities where they have tents and they're growing crops in large buildings and tents, have CO2 generators. And
yes,
they push CO2 levels to 2,000 parts per million.
Yes,
and that's
true.
That gets them their best plant growth.
Yeah,
and the
interesting thing is
2,000 parts per million are what you would measure in a kindergarten classroom at the end of an hour.
Yeah, so as part of my global warming class, we have a device that measures the CO2, and we put them in the classroom and watch how it changes throughout the class. And mm-hmm. 2,000 is getting pretty high. If you get up to 2,000, students are getting sleepy and having trouble focusing. But if you have a well-ventilated room, it shouldn't get up that high. But you can easily double CO2 from 400 to 800 over an hour or 2 hours.
Yep. Yeah. Wow. So, in your opinion, is all of the push from Al Gore and AOC and others a warranted push?
Well,
do we need a lot more understanding of what's happening before we make commitments that they're asking us to make?
We should be careful to group large groups of people together. I think Al Gore and AOC's perspective are fairly different. But here's what I would say. I would say you can try to understand this from a conservative perspective. So let's take Edmund Burke, who argues that society has developed over thousands of years and we don't fully understand it, so we shouldn't try to radically change it without knowing what's going to happen if we do that. You know, if you knock out one group of people, the consequences could be immense, the unforeseen
the butterfly
consequences.
Effect.
Exactly. And so you can make a similar argument that I think resonates with conservatives' fundamental intuition based on Burke's logic for society. So the global environment is an extremely complex system that we don't fully understand. And if we change it drastically and thoughtlessly, we might be afraid of where it might lead us. I also find the religious perspective to be compelling. So Pope Francis, Patriarch Bartholomew, and the former chief rabbi Sacks have all made statements affirming that there's a theological justification for environmental conservation, and that's based on man's role as steward of God's earth. And so there are a variety of ways that you can think about this from a conservative perspective, while of course remembering that there are always trade-offs and not falling prey to a sort of extremism or a hyperbolic destructive narrative of the future, but still saying this is something that we should take seriously and let's think rationally about the best way to do it that's going to cause the least amount of damage to humans.
Well, I talked to, as you can imagine, I talk to a lot of conservatives all around the world on a daily basis, and I have yet to find anybody who does not agree that we need to take care of the earth.
Yeah. You know, so that's a good place to start from on these conversations.
It sure is. So what is it that drives some people in science to make amazing claims that don't happen? You know, the threats of sea levels rising such that New York will disappear, you know, things like that are major claims. And they've been made by some fairly reputable scientists.
Well, you know, the sea level, so let's take this question from a general perspective. From a general perspective, I think it's difficult to unpack the motivations of other people, and I'd rather not speculate on that. If we consider the sea level issue, if we consider the sea level issue in particular, what you find is there is the capability for a large amount of sea level rise. It's, you know, it's something like close to 300 feet of sea level rise if all of the ice melts. What's important is the time scale. So it's not going to happen in our lifetimes, but it's something that on a civilizational time scale, you know, 2,000 years from now, it is possible that we could have lost Greenland and a significant portion of Antarctica. And if that happens, there will be a significant sea level rise. That is true. But it's not something that's going to happen in your children's lifetime, particular thing.
Antarctica is an amazing topic. I've not been there. I hope to remedy that. But you're talking about a cold place. It's sitting on top of a volcanic vent. How does it have ice at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the main way you get an ice sheet like that is you have to have more snow in the winter than you have melting in the summer. And it turns out that melting in the summer is the key issue. It's pretty easy to melt a lot of ice in the summer, even if you build up a lot of snow in the winter. And you can see that in places like at ski resorts where they get, you know, I don't know, they could have 6 feet or 10 feet of snow in the winter and it still melts all summer because it gets so hot in the summer. And so the critical thing is that in Antarctica, you've got conditions so you don't melt away the ice in the summer and then it packs up and slowly builds up. And then once the ice sheet starts getting higher and higher, well, now it's colder when you go up higher, like when you go up higher on a mountain. And so that makes it easier to keep the ice sheet around. So there's sort of a nonlinear feedback built into the system.
Absolutely. Well, you know, NASA and space exploration has really helped our understanding of the Earth, the ability to take pictures and understand and actually see the changes just has to open everybody's eyes. For instance, there were 12,000 more square miles of land than there were 10 years ago, according to NASA.
That's interesting. And I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And in Antarctica, I believe it's the eastern ice shelf has been melting like crazy, but the total ice content of Antarctica has been growing because the other side of Antarctica has been gaining ice faster than it's been losing it.
Yeah, I understand there's a lot of debate about that issue, and I'm not an expert on it, but that's definitely a hypothesis that's been put out.
It's really interesting, and thank goodness for satellite photography, because it takes a lot of the conjecture and guesswork out of the issue.
It's true, yeah. So it's not just photography. They're doing a variety of different techniques. One thing they're doing, like you say, is photography. Another thing they're doing is they're doing laser measurements of the actual position of the ice. And another thing they're doing is gravitational evidence measurements that tell them how much mass there is of ice.
Yeah. It's amazing what you scientists can do for us. I love it.
Great.
I was watching a video with two astrophysicists. Now, I take it that astro and geophysicists are totally different topics.
No, not that different. In fact, a lot of the stuff I work on overlaps with astrophysics, and I publish a lot of papers in the Astrophysical Journal.
Oh, fabulous. Well, I was watching, there were two of them, while Willie Soon, mm-hmm. who's a Malaysian scientist, and Elliot Bloom, who's an American, I believe. But the interesting thing was Willie was talking about the ozone scare that went around some decades ago, that, you know, there was a hole in the ozone and it was disappearing. And he laughed quite readily about that. And he said, ozone replaces itself. If you took all the ozone out of the atmosphere today, it would be back in 15 days. Not years, not decades, days.
Yeah. Well, so with the ozone hole in particular, though, if you're actively destroying it, even if it comes back, you still get these periods where the dangerous UV can get through.
Yeah, well, it certainly
has a health impact.
Yeah, it certainly affects Australians like crazy.
Yeah.
They don't call them madmen for nothing down there. I lived in Australia for 23 years, and I loved it.
You know, my dad was a carpenter, and when I was a kid, he told me about a job he was on with four Australian roofers, and they had a whole case full of beer, and they'd go up on the roof and work all day, and they'd each have about 20 beers, and they were able to get the job done.
Well, that's absolutely not a surprise to me. I totally love Australians. When I took my first job there, I was CEO of a company. I got head on it. And the first thing my PA said to me was, how do you want your bar stocked? And I said, excuse me, what? And she walked into my office, pushed on a wooden door on a wall, and it opened up, and there was a complete bar, a total, you know, and I was expected to entertain like crazy.
Wow.
And that's, you know, it's a different life. And it was so wonderful getting to experience how other parts of the world live and what they expect out of things. Well, I'll tell you, Dorian, this has been terrific. I really want to help any way I can, and I hope you will call on me. Is there any way our listeners can jump into this? Is there a website they can go to or anything?
Are we thinking about the climate issue?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Yeah, there's a great website. It's called RepubN. Let me see. I don't have it pulled up right now, but there is a group. It's led by a former representative from South Carolina, I believe. And it's a group devoted to making the conservative case for dealing with climate change and coming up with conservative solutions to do that.
Fabulous. Really great. Dorian, thank you so very much for your time. You've been a marvelous guest. And maybe if we're lucky, we'll get to do it again.
That sounds great to me. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
And that'll do it for another hour of the Conservative Thought Hour. We're here every Saturday from 9 until 10. You can subscribe to the free newsletter, The American. Just text your email to 408-389-1958. They never share your information. Or you can email American Endeavor. You can email the Conservative Thought Hour people. And that email is newsletter at AmericanEndeavorInc.com. American Endeavor, ENDEAVORINC.com. Alternatively, if you'd like to sponsor our fight to keep broadcasting conservative values, go to our website at www.AmericanEndeavorInc.com. You can also call 941-202-2211 and ask for Rick.
Thank you for listening to the Conservative Thought Hour. Remember what Albert Einstein said. The world is a very dangerous place, not because of the evil men in it, but because of the good men who do nothing.